Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, this is Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is poet Rita Dove, whose most recent work is On the Bus with Rosa Parks, published by Norton. Her work is famous for its meditations on family and history, on the individual and her effect on culture. Ms. Dove has served as America's Poet Laureate. Selected poems, published by Vintage, includes her first three books of poetry, The Yellow House on the Corner, Museum, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Thomas and Beulah. Her other works include Mother Love, Grace Notes, a book of short stories, Fifth Sunday, a novel, Through the Ivory Gate, and a play, The Darker Face of the Earth. Today's show was recorded at a reading of Rita Dove's new poems in Santa Fe as part of Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversations series. Before our conversation, Rita Dove reads American Smooth, the title poem from her upcoming book to be published by Norton.
About 5 years ago, lightning struck our house, and it burned down, and we were going through the rubble for days, and we had these wonderful neighbors who were always helping us, and one day they came to us, a few of them came and said, here are some tickets, we're all going to a dinner dance. You're going to get out of these dirty clothes and go by yourself. Rita, you're going to buy yourself a formal. Fred, you're going to buy a tuxedo. Let's get out of this. And so they performed for us, I think, a really valuable thing. I mean, it was a, what they did, they reminded us that there was beauty in the world and that one could dance on the ashes and still feel good. They also started us on the track of ballroom dancing, because at this at this dance, we saw these couples just float by, and I said, I've always wanted to do that. And one of our neighbors, Esther, said, let's go do lessons. And she organized it, and we all went out and did these lessons. My husband, Fred, and I were the only ones who stuck with it. We've been dancing ever since. It's been wonderful. So a whole group of dance poems have emerged. An American Smooth, that title, I won't keep you in suspense any longer, refers to the smooth dances, the American version of the smooth dances, which are waltz, foxtrot, tango. And the American version is a little looser than the European one. You can actually separate from your partner and do things for brief moments and come back. American Smooth. We were dancing. It must have been a foxtrot or a waltz, something romantic but requiring restraint, rise and fall, precise execution as we moved into the next song without stopping, two chests heaving above a seven-league stride. Such perfect agony one learns to smile through, ecstatic mimicry being the sine qua non of American Smooth. And because I was distracted by the effort of keeping my frame, the leftward lean, head turned just enough to gaze out past your ear and always smiling, smiling, I didn't notice how still you'd become until we had done it. For two measures, four, achieved flight, that swift and serene magnificence before the earth remembered who we were and brought us down.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is a very special kind of interview for me because I only received some of the new poems today, and Rita Dove is the first poet I've ever spoken to in front of you whom I've never spoken to before. There was no prior contact, whatever. And so I felt myself experiencing these poems. It's a very... a new poem. You know, it's an enormously intense thing and an honor to look at a typed page as opposed to a printed page. But when I was reading American Smooth, I saw hidden rhymes that move from the scene in sine qua non to the leftward lean to that swift and serene, and it seemed as if, you know, like the orchestra, the hidden rhyme, which is only once at the end of a line, is moving the poem forward, that's the propulsion.
Absolutely right. That's great. That's wonderful. Because, well, I mean, I... Gee.
I was so nervous.
No, that's absolutely right. So many of my poems have internal rhyme as opposed to end-stop rhyme. And for me, it's also a little bit of jazz. It's like instead of having the courtly four-beat, you know, sensation of a ballad or something that's going to... You know where the rhyme is. The rhyme will pop up where you least expect it, give you a little syncopation, and you've got it, and yet it ties it together in a way that you hopefully aren't aware of on first reading, but you just feel it. So, yeah, and I love internal rhyme. I do it all the time. So you caught me. It's good.
No, I don't mean to.
No, it's great. I think it's great. No one's ever really mentioned it before.
Well, I think that people don't really read poetry. They, mm-hmm. you know, they go straight from the poem to ideas. And I don't know why this is. And one of the things that I noticed when you were reading that almost, I apologize, because I spoke about an idea in my introduction about the individual and the universal. But what I heard as I was listening to the poems had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the poems themselves, and you know, it's a funny kind of thing. I wanted to ask you about the ideas that critics have in relation to the making of poems.
My poems, the making of my poems,
the making of your poems.
Well, it's curious because, of course, when a critic, by the time the critic has read the work and done something on it, I've moved on. And so I'll read them occasionally. I won't read them right away, but I'll read them. And I have read practically everything anyone said about me and some of the things, you know. But in a certain way, I think, oh, that's kind of neat. Oh, they like that. Okay, fine. But it doesn't really affect me because I am somewhere else tackling some other who knows what. And I also I get very protective about my creative time, as you realize, because you couldn't speak to me beforehand, because I was actually finishing this book. And I like to be in the dark in terms of what I'm doing. I don't like to think about it in any conscious terms, because then I can't get there. The picture, and I've talked about this in some other interviews, but the picture of the poem gets formed, each poem gets formed by fragments. And I don't work from beginning to end, and I don't work with an idea. I work with lines, I work with the sound, and there may be a story behind it, but I'm less interested in the story than I am the way it's told, the way you apprehend it. So it's hard for me to talk about things until they're done, and then once they're done and someone's done a critique on it, I don't care.
The reason why I ask is... Yeah. That, you know, for the longest time, the thing that I was most grateful to in my life, really, I didn't think I would ever understand poetry. I began as a kind of prose and story person, and it wasn't until I'd left college that I started to understand how to read poetry. Mm-hmm. And I was always so afraid of not understanding it, truly afraid. And I know that people want to think of, you know, someone who does what I do as an intellectual, but it's not really the case. I'm so afraid of not knowing, not understanding, not being deep enough. And no, really. It's an awful thing because, you know, I was in school where, you know, you open a book of Ezra Pound and you don't go three words until you're confused. You know what I mean?
Oh, gosh. You know, the thing that probably saved me when I was in junior high school was a teacher who took us all in an English class, and he broke us up into groups, he gave each of us a portion of some poem without the author's name, told us we had a week to figure out what it meant. We had to present a report. My group got some section of the Cantos, of course, Ezra Pound.
No.
We're 15.
Yes.
There was Greek in it, you know. Yeah. In Greek letters, and we're looking at this, and there were five of us in a group, and we just started laughing. We said, we can't do this. And we said, and everyone, every group, there was, you know, despair breaking out. And he said, then make it up. Come on, you know, this is fun. He says, just guess. And so we had a week to do this, which was good because we went home, we looked up stuff in books, we looked up French, we guessed. We just guessed. We said, oh, it must mean this, it must. And finally, it was a game. We gave our report, and then he read to us a little section from a critic. And it wasn't too far off. And what he was trying to say was that we weren't guessing. You know, that's something right. that you that's can right. actually, you can get if you just relax. If you just relax and let it wash over you, you can get a lot. You don't have to understand a poem first time, all of it. You don't have to understand in 20 years. You might take a part of it with you all the time. And then 20 years later, you say, gosh, that means something entirely different to me. That's okay. So that saved me in a way.
Well, I've always said that the first time I was ever able to understand anything about the wasteland was when I looked at the first page. There were Greek letters, and then there were things that looked like Latin, and then there was, for Ezra Pound, something in Italian. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the poem is about people who don't know what each other are saying. That is the subject of the poem. That's how
great.
The poem
Absolutely.
Starts.
Absolutely.
And you're just supposed to look at it. That's the point. You're not supposed to immediately mm-hmm. do the research. So I've always wondered that, because it seems to me that so much of what holds readers from poetry is something that poets themselves have to conquer in order, you know, mm-hmm. How do you stop from being intimidated by all this stuff, these barnacles that have gathered around poems?
Yeah, how do you stop? You start small. I'm at my feelings that you start small. I don't sit down saying I'm going to write a poem. I never do. And in fact, I rarely start with a blank page. I mean, you know, I'll scribble on it. I'll do something else. I doodle. But I go... I have a notebook. I put in it anything that interests me, which means it can be recipes, grocery list, you know, a word I overhear. That's the only requirement. It's the only requirement. These are not poems. This is just my scrapbook. And eventually, I just look through it. I say, I'm not looking for poems. I'm just looking through my scrapbook. And eventually, things start to float and come together. You know, it is piecing together the subconscious. You start small until something compels, at least for me, something compels me so much that I'm ready to go, sit down, and work on it.
It's so interesting to me that you mentioned recipes, because one of the things that I, you know, it's just like, I always think, again, pardon me, why are people so silly? Because, you know, there's in Patterson, you know, by William Carlos Williams, he includes this interview with Mike Wallace, a very young mm-hmm. Mike Wallace. And one of the parts that Wallace quotes is this grocery list that William Carlos Williams has included in the poem. Mm-hmm. And there's all this fuss, and critics have written about it, too. Why a grocery list in the poem? Why a grocery list? Well, obviously, because it looks like a poem. It's one of the few things in people's lives that they write with short lines going down the page. And he's interested in this because this is where poetry connects with people. Because he's yeah. a doctor and sees people, ordinary people, who don't read poems every day, but they do make grocery lists.
Yeah. but you know, on the other side, we look at things that look like poems. Immediately people go, they get tense, you know, and they think, yeah, oh, my gosh, different. I'm not going to be able to understand this.
Now, your father told you that he doesn't read much poetry when you told him that you were going to be a poet, and that he said it was okay with him if you would understand that he wouldn't be reading it very much.
Right.
Was that okay with you?
That was great, actually. I mean, at that point, you go, phew, okay, I can write the poems I want to write. But no, also, I respected what he was saying at that point, and I was in college at that point, and I went in, and he thought I was going to be a lawyer, and I told him I was going to be a poet. He could have said something much worse, and he didn't. And I thought, that's fine. He's a chemist, you know, I'm a poet, it's okay. He does read them now, actually, you know. We do talk about them, so it's okay. When I was poet laureate, it's incredible to me how many people would write me and say things. They'd start off, they preface all their letters with, I've always been afraid of poetry, but... And then they proceed to talk about these poems that they loved when they were kids, but they didn't understand. And I'm going, you know, what is this amazing fear we have of poetry?
Well, they've been taught that they don't understand. That's what they learned in school.
Yeah. And they don't have enough of it in school either. I mean, I think that before kids even learn how to read, they should just poem a day. You know, teacher, just read the poem in kindergarten, read it in preschool, and then just let it hang in the air. That's enough.
Well, I've noticed in a couple of your talks and essays that you come into classes. In one class, you ask people to draw a picture of what they think of when they hear the word poem, having brought in computer paper, which you refuse to let them tear them. Hold margins off of, and crayons, and that in another class and another essay, you asked people to come in dressed in a way that they wouldn't want to be seen in public.
Yes, that was rough. We're all hiding in the bathroom trying to scoot down the hallway, you know.
But this is part of the teaching of poetry, and it's a different way of teaching, and I wondered if you'd talk about that.
Well, I think that... Yes, I think that poetry is, it's interesting because you have on the one hand the intellectualization of poetry and how people are, you know, you talk about it and it's very wise and all this stuff. On the other hand, it really is about living. It really is about, in fact, the brutish kinds of emotions that we have, whether they're good or bad. And yet... we're using language to try to get at something that is absolutely, which should strike you speechless. There are no words for it. Shame and despair and all the big words that you're also forbidden to use in poetry, I mean, because they don't mean anything in the general. So one of the things I discovered is that, you know, the hardest thing about writing, getting kids to write poetry or students to write poetry is for them to connect again to the brutish and to realize that that's part of, in fact, the essential part of poetry. So drawing with crayons, I mean, they were appalled. I mean, most of the students, and these were graduate students, they had a harder time with the crayons than they did with dressing as something that they didn't want to be. Because the dressing was more like Halloween, but the crayons, that brought them back to a time when they couldn't write. Mm. They didn't want to be there.
Well, you see, I was thrilled by something that someone told me about you. That the person told me disparagingly, but I heard it and said, oh, goody. Someone said that she remembered you in poetry workshop in Iowa and that you used to paint your nails. Now, I'm looking at these beautiful nails at the moment, which are extraordinary, and I say to myself... Well, isn't that great? Because I know all my life, even when I would listen to people like Robert Creeley, I never understood what he was talking about. I took it in, but I just couldn't get what he meant. You know, the field and the, you know, it was so, you know, like abstract. So I said, oh, exactly. I used to sit in classes when I didn't understand things and draw things on my hand and on the bottoms of my sneakers. And I thought... she must be something like me.
Isn't it crazy that people feel that, you know, to be a poet, to be an artist, that you have to conform to a certain look?
You have to behave.
You
too.
Have to behave. You have to be, you know, you have to, you certainly shouldn't paint your nails.
Not in class.
No.
Yeah.
Do that in class. But, but no, I don't know. It's part of, and it sounds corny to say this, but it's part of the joy of living. I mean, if you have something decorated, why not?
No. I felt afterwards angry at the people who kept me from poetry by suggesting that it was a different order of things than the things I loved. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, if anyone had told me that poets were like me, only more so, I'd have come to them.
You would have been there
first, you know. Yeah. And I think about what it means to have a culture that puts so many obstacles between, you know, I always say to people now, you know, because I think the culture right now is very interested in teaching young people, especially young people of different ethnicities, that education isn't important. Mm. And why do they want to teach them that? The one thing we do have in America that changes your life is the ability to tell your own story. You tell it, people hear it, it enters the culture. If you don't have the language with which to tell your story, as eccentric, as beautiful, as strange and ungrammatical as that may be, if you lose the belief that the telling of your story is of immense importance, because this is how people secretly, this is how people change class in America. This is how people move from one realm to the other, and it doesn't cost anything. You don't have to invest in it. You develop your specificity, and you become your people's person. You know, it alters everything.
Yes.
Everything. And they're busy taking it away. I think it's a very canny thing.
It's very canny. Yes, exactly why they're taking it away.
Yeah, to teach people that education isn't important is what they are learning in school now.
Because if you don't have education, if it isn't important, and if you don't understand that your story is vital and important, it should not be snuffed out, then you're much more willing to go to war, become part of a machinery of part of that team. It's smart. Yeah, it's
definitely. Now, in the books, and I think they're in some kind of progression, conscious or unconscious, there are essentially photograph albums. Thomas and Beulah records moments, transient moments, absolutely small ones that could only be captured in a flicker. But then in the Rosa Parks book, you've got the cameos, and I think they're meant to reflect on the Thomas and Beulah poems in a new way. Mm-hmm. And I think then, later in that very book, there's that question of who becomes known. You know, it could have been anyone. It could have, they don't want to... trashy teenager, you know, and that sense that these poems that you've done, it's part of the originality. It thinks they're never, I think they're never coming from the same place. It's not a repetition, you know. We love Thomas and Beulah, the Pulitzer. No, it's like, oh yeah, I won that prize, but there was something I didn't yet know. Just as in Mother Love. Mm-hmm. There's the relationship between Demeter and Persephone, but in this poem about Salome, it's like, I forgot something about mothers and daughters, that sometimes a mother can use the daughter as a sexual prize. That wasn't in that. In other words, it's always going further and going past.
Well, things are always changing. The truth is not a stationary thing. It is an X marks the spot. I mean, I don't pursue it consciously that way, but I'm always constant. If a poem doesn't, as I'm working on, if it doesn't surprise me at some point, if it doesn't open up, if that, you know, if Biz doesn't kind of yawn at some point, you go, ooh, then it's not a poem. It's not worth it to share it to anyone because it hasn't had any kind of discovery. And so, yes, it's constantly happening. One of the things I do, I mean, how do I get there? How do I get to this kind of discovery? You have to learn to trick yourself. I mean, I'll often go after it technically. After finishing Thomas and Beulah, and doing that long narrative, I decided that I couldn't do anything like that again for a while. When I got to Mother Love, I decided to write sonnets. One sonnet came out, and so I said, okay. And I didn't want to write sonnets. Nobody wants to write a book of sonnets, but it was something about the shape of the sonnet and what it inspires in us, the hope it inspires in us, the enclosure, the protection that it seems to promise because it's 14 lines and it's supposed to rhyme and close, that I wanted to explore that cage.
Well, it interests me. I once heard John Ashbery saying about the poems and paradoxes and oxymorons that they were all almost sonnets, but not quite, because he wanted to insult the smug complacency of that sonnet thing. And, and I noticed that in the Salome poems, which are linked to the mother-daughter subject, they're all almost sonnets. They almost go to 14 lines, but stop just the four. And yeah. I thought that this was still part of the path of yes. making the subject.
Right, making the subject, changing it, yeah. That's cool. I mean, he notices a lot. Amazing.
Well, but you see, I love meaning. You know, I don't mean secret meaning. I don't mean meaning that intellectuals are looking for. I mean that we live in a meaningful world.
Yeah.
And that the thoughts that we translate onto the page in poem and essay, they're meant to be meaningful. And they're meant to give people access to the idea of significance, yes. relevance. Unlike the people, the sisters you wrote about, who died of insignificance, that we want an art that showers the reader with significance.
Yes, yes, we do. And I firmly believe this. I mean, though I would never write a poem, write down in a poem or whatever that means. I don't even know what that means, you know, trying to make it understandable. My belief is that you will understand it with your left elbow, maybe, but, you know, it will be understandable if it seduces you. If it seduces you with its sounds, if a poem doesn't sing for me, if I'm writing it, I'm not interested in it. It really has to have that beauty on many levels before it can become a poem and before it becomes significant, because then the beauty invades you everywhere. It comes in under your footsoles, you know, it seeps in all around you.
Well, I've been speaking to Rita Dove. It's been an honor and a pleasure. I loved meeting you. I was so nervous.
No, it's wonderful. You can go on and on. Thanks, Michael. Thank you. Great.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. This interview was taped before a live audience in Santa Fe. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. This is Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouth Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.